And so for people who may not think that antitrust or fair markets impacts them, it does, unfortunately, probably more ways than you would like to know.
Welcome to the 389th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. At a pair of LSP town hall meetings held earlier this year in western Minnesota, farmers and other rural residents had a clear message for State Attorney General Keith Ellison. Unprecedented consolidation in agriculture is emptying the landscape of farmers, which is having a trickle-down effect on everything from rural schools and churches to Main Street businesses, as well as our environmental health. I think probably the most important issue facing us in the rural community today is consolidation, Daryl Mosel, a Sibley County crop and livestock farmer, told Ellison. That's no exaggeration. Consider this. Four large firms handle 85% of all beef cattle purchases and 67% of all hog purchases. Just seven corporations control roughly half of the grain and oilseed market globally. During a recent 12-month period, Minnesota, the nation's sixth largest dairy producing state, saw 146 dairy farms go out of business, a 7% drop. Meanwhile, mega dairies with tens of thousands of cows now control more market share than ever, according to industry reports. Take a drive through any rural community in the Midwest, and the results of all this consolidation is evident. Shuttered businesses, empty schools, and fewer farmsteads. As antitrust expert Austin Frerich told me in Ear to the Ground 384, we're in uncharted waters when it comes to corporate control of agriculture. And all of this consolidation is threatening to make rural communities mere extraction colonies for modern robber barons. Participants in the LSP town halls asked the Attorney General to investigate whether processors and input suppliers were violating the law through monopolistic control of the markets. Fortunately, Elizabeth Odette was on hand at one of the meetings to hear those concerns firsthand. Elizabeth manages the Antitrust Division of the Attorney General's Office and is the Antitrust Task Force Chair of the National Association of Attorneys General. In her role, she's in charge of gathering evidence of examples of firms exerting illegal market control through price fixing, bid rigging, and outright monopolization, among other things. Her division has already started to take on giant agricultural corporations like John Deere, Syngenta, and Agristats. The average citizen might be surprised at how many laws are on the books that are meant to prevent big corporations from engaging in practices that make it impossible for small and medium-sized farms to compete. But as Ellison and Odette make clear, the key is to make sure those laws are enforced. It turns out state attorney general offices have a fair amount of power when it comes to investigating and prosecuting examples of firms violating both state and federal laws. But as Elizabeth explained to town hall participants, her office can't prosecute a case based on rumors. They need hard evidence to pursue a case, and that means they need to hear directly from the farmers and others who are being negatively impacted by consolidation. I caught up with Elizabeth after the town hall she attended to talk more about what her office can do to help create a fairer marketplace for farms and rural communities, how folks can report evidence directly to the Attorney General, and why everyone, farmers and non-farmers alike, should care about agricultural antitrust issues. She started our conversation by defining what exactly unfair market control looks like in our day-to-day lives.
I think we hear the word antitrust and it sounds really confusing. I think that we are looking more to say unfair markets or unfair competition. And really the words that are in the laws that we use to enforce use the words like restricting competition or monopolizing markets or harming consumers. And it refers often to specific actions. And some of these people may be familiar with, like, price fixing or bid rigging. There's also market allocation or tying different goods and services together and forcing people to purchase them together. Or, you know, then the big one, monopolization. And these are all violations of either the U.S. federal laws or state laws, and state antitrust enforcers can sue under both.
There has been a lot of talk kind of in the kind of general media and in general public discussion around unfair competition, unfair market control of, say, Silicon Valley and Wall Street. You know, Wall Street's been a long time, but Silicon Valley is a more recent thing. And I've always kind of wondered, is there a chance that agriculture could get overlooked? Is that something kind of gets overlooked? Because these are the more, I guess, the big sexy things out there that control so much of our economy. I mean, in agriculture, I always feel like it gets short shrift on a lot of areas. People kind of overlook it. But are we in danger of overlooking it as far as the harm that control of that market can have?
Yeah, I think there is a more recent focus, I think, on agriculture. But I think the consolidation in the agriculture markets over the recent decades has allowed certain companies to be really entrenched in their market power in ways that is just going to be harder to address, you know, than in the tech space. But recently, the Department of Justice announced formalizing a partnership with the USDA, and it's to protect competition in key agriculture markets, such as feed, fertilizer, fuel, seed, equipment, and other essential goods. And I really do see this as a good step. And as part of my role with the National Association of Attorneys General, I'm in communication with the Department of Justice to see how states' attorney general can work with them on these issues. But it is true that most of what we have seen in, you know, the media covering are these big tech companies. But I think there is an advantage to this when it comes to agriculture, because sometimes you look and there are agriculture cases that can be tech cases because you're thinking of data and technology. And so sometimes I worry that we do look at tech cases as, well, it's the tech company and they're the ones that are monopolizing tech in a tech product. But we also have to look at technology in the agriculture space and how technology might be used by some of these companies to be kind of using their market power to hold on to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of fuzz across those boundaries a little bit these days with technology kind of infiltrating everything a little bit.
Right, that's true. And I think, you know, we've started to become more aware of and comfortable with how much data is being collected about us as people, but that goes for other things as well in the agriculture space. And so I think for people to be thinking about how that might be in their, you know, work, and then thinking about, am I signing something that's maybe giving people more access to data than I would necessarily like, and maybe I should look more into that.
Could you back up a little bit and give us, you know, we talk about agriculture maybe being overlooked a little bit, but historically, I mean, antitrust laws have applied to, there's been a history of looking at agriculture and what control certain companies have over even just movement of agricultural goods, that kind of thing. But there's some laws that, longstanding laws that apply to agriculture or any kind of, any area of antitrust.
Yeah, so if we go way, way back in why antitrust laws were passed in the first place, we're looking back to the 1800s, and there was a legal mechanism called a trust, but not in the way we think about it today. It was a legal way for a bunch of companies, or just a couple companies, to be able to do things collectively together and under the control of just a few people or a few companies. And the biggest example of this was the Rockefeller Company Standard Oil. And once companies kind of saw that model, or sorry, once consumers saw that model and were realizing how much power only a few people had in the areas and industries where this was where the country was going. It was the Industrial Revolution, and they were controlling the ability for anybody to kind of be in that space and innovate themselves. And so it was called trust busting.
Yeah.
And so the Sherman Act was passed in the 1880s, and then about 25 years later, the Clayton Act was passed, and that was to really look at mergers. So those were the big federal laws that were passed. Then over the years, slowly states started passing laws, but then in the 1970s, was really when there was concern over a retreat by the federal enforcers in antitrust enforcement, and states wanted to really have their own robust antitrust laws. And so you'll see, for example, in Minnesota, our Minnesota antitrust law is called the Minnesota Antitrust Law of 1971.
I got to say, I'm kind of impressed that
back then, because like you said, the Industrial Revolution was the future. That's, everybody was really excited about that. That even back then, folks, decision makers, the general public were recognizing, oh, we can't just let this be a free-for-all. We really do have to kind of put some controls on it. I mean, it kind of makes you feel hopeful about that people can recognize that a little bit, because it gets a little, again, I hate to focus on Silicon Valley too much, but there's so much of a focus on the future of AI and the future of technology and automation and all of that. And if folks could recognize that we need to put a little bit, some controls on some of this, back then, I mean, it gives me hope for now a little bit.
Yeah, and our Attorney General may have even mentioned at the meetings he's had with your members that there were groups of people back then that were meeting and talking about the trust busting, and it was those groups of people that organized to pressure Congress to get these laws passed. So you're right that there is a model for it and an opportunity for people to be talking about it. And I will say, in my 20-plus years of practice, I see much more everyday discourse and commentary about monopolies, about consolidation. And I think it's natural because people are seeing in their everyday lives prices going up. They're not having as many choices of what they can buy and where they can buy it. And they're looking to and understanding that our competition laws are maybe a way that we can improve that.
Focusing on agriculture specifically, what would be some examples of antitrust violations or kind of unfair market type of situations? What would they actually look like to folk that folks would recognize? And I guess one of the things, I was looking at your fact sheet and you used some terms like price discrimination and supplier favoritism. I was wondering if you could describe what are the, because these are the kind of things that you would be looking for if somebody came to you with what they thought was a violation. And so I think it'd be helpful for folks to kind of know what exactly are we looking at when we're actually investigating something as being illegal.
Right. So that is focusing on a particular area that you mentioned, like price discrimination, and that can be fact dependent. And one thing that I try to explain when I'm talking about price discrimination is people are familiar with volume discounts. Mm-hmm. So if you're buying print photos or holiday cards, yeah. The more you buy, the less it is per print. That's not price discrimination. And neither is having certain fees tied to costs that are maybe more expensive, like transportation. However, you know, some companies aren't transparent about how they reach that final price with people. And they use terms like volume discount or transportation costs as excuses. And so trying to get as much information about the breakdown of what a purchase is comprised of would help better understand where there is an issue worth exploring. And so, you know, I think of, you know, this is often brought up in the context of a grocery store, right? And you may have an independent grocer who has a big contract with a wholesaler, and there's really not a lot of detail provided to them about what they're paying for certain items. And that's where I just use that as an analogy, but that could be in, you know, other contracts that people have as well, where you're buying a bunch of things to help with your farm and you may be getting it all from one particular place, but it's maybe not broken down. I'm trying to better understand where those costs are and what makes them up. And sometimes, you know, they are required to do that under their contract, but maybe they don't. Then you can look closer to see, well, wait a minute, they may be saying to me as they're selling this to me that it's a volume discount or it's transportation, but that's not what it says there. It just says the price is the price. So how, and you know, pushing back a little bit, like how can I know that you're treating me fairly if you're not giving me the detail?
This is probably not a good analogy, but I think of, there's a lot of concern about pesticides and how when they look at the label, there's a whole category called inert ingredients that nobody knows what the heck is in there. And it's a way to hide some stuff a little bit. And also, I think about price discovery for farmers who are selling, this idea that they don't know what is the fair price out there because all that is being kept kind of secret about who's getting paid what. They don't even know what their neighbor's getting paid, so they don't know if they're being competitive or not.
That's right. I think, yeah, price discovery is something also that companies will try to prevent others from, you know, like you said, it's a way that you can determine whether or not you're being treated fairly. I think another term that's out there is, you said, like supplier favoritism, and the example I think of is, you know, on a Sunday on for football, the Doritos are going to be displayed prominently at the front of the grocery store. Well, that's probably something that, you know, they've worked out with the company that supplies the Doritos to get that product placement. But if there's a short supply of something and one particular company is getting shorted over and over and over again, that is something that probably is worth looking into, because that is no longer supplier favoritism. It might be discrimination against that supplier when it's constantly shorted and it's not getting what it's supposed to be. That's maybe something that they should be looking into.
I just, as an aside, I hear a lot from dairy farmers who are concerned about this situation where the big processors will pick up milk from big producers for free. And they don't charge them a hauler fee, that kind of thing. Where does that lie as far as the legality of it?
Yeah, that would be something that we would be interested in hearing about, because it would depend on if they're doing that in a way that I've described, where it's part of a volume or other type of discount that they're receiving that is based on some sort of cost effectiveness or efficiency that they're seeing. But if it's not, and it's simply they're doing it to try to reduce the number of stops they make, then that's something that's more of a problem.
So in a sense, do antitrust violations kind of creep up on us, or are they part of that as they get interwoven into our daily business activities? You know, it gets hard, and maybe that's part of the idea, is it gets hard to tell what is illegal and what's just, well, that's just the way we do business kind of thing. Or can we point to big catastrophic events, I guess, or big events out there that are like, okay, that's antitrust violation right there. We can really nail it right there.
So I don't think it has to be one or the other. Okay. I think it's a little bit of both. So I think there may be instances where a business relationship starts off just fine, but over time, more onerous restrictions or terms are imposed. And it could be also that you see a company that you do business with had big merger or a consolidation or a new partnership. And those types of announcements in conjunction with new or onerous terms or conditions, that could be something that's worth looking at, right? But I would acknowledge that it's hard. I am not one that's always interested in taking the time to document a bad experience. And that's really what we're asking for here, is to relive your bad experience. But, you know, our office depends upon that, and knowledge is power. And so knowing more, even if it's a small piece of that larger puzzle, is helpful. And we don't always know about the new partnerships or consolidations that, you know, other people are seeing. We don't always know about changes being rolled out for terms or prices, large groups of vendors. And so, you know, going back to some of the examples we've talked about, you know, seeing that, you know, you have maybe three choices from different vendors, and all three of them come out with price increases in the same week. That would be something that would be really helpful for us to know. And we're not getting the, you know, customer letters. But if you're talking and you hear about those types of things, that example is like a red flag.
That's a really good example, because that defeats the whole purpose of being able to shop around in competition, is if they're all coming out, that shows collusion. I could see that.
So it may or may not. So it shows that there may be collusion behind it, because the timing is very suspicious. Okay. But if you think about like a gas station, and they look across the street and they see someone raising prices, and then they raise them. So the timing of it and how they came to the conclusion, I mean, if they all happened in the same week, they're probably sending out the emails at the same time or similar time. But if one happens and then it's a month later and then a month later, the further they are spread out, the harder it is. But it can be quite suspicious if it's not tied to something concrete, like an increase in input costs.
So one of the things that came up at a recent meeting that we had with you and the Attorney General was we had a pretty good discussion on concerns about cooperatives engaging in antitrust behavior. And I think people would be a little bit surprised. I mean, Minnesota in particular, the Upper Midwest, is proud of its cooperative culture and history, and it's done a lot of good for farmers. But I think people might be a little surprised that there is maybe some issues with them, these cooperatives that are supposed to be representing the farmers, engaging in antitrust behavior.
Yes, so there are exemptions for antitrust for cooperatives, because they're designed, like you said, to help groups of small farmers, you know, group together to get more equal bargaining power, usually through pooling resources or collectively marketing their products. But they're not above all antitrust laws. And so I looked after the meeting to see, you know, what examples of lawsuits that exist out there against cooperatives. And the ones that are out there, and they're in interesting areas like mushrooms and potatoes and processed eggs, and they're across the country. They're focused on those cooperatives pushing the boundaries of restricting supply and other things that then impact the larger market, and those who are harmed are consumers. So that's just an example, even though not what I think we directly heard at the meeting, of how cooperatives, even though they have some antitrust exemptions, are not above all antitrust laws. But when you're looking at your own cooperatives and what they may be doing, you'll probably want to look first at internal governance. How are they supposed to be operating? What transparency are they supposed to be providing? Are the leadership following the legal and governance requirements? You probably have bylaws and other things set out by federal and state statute before looking at antitrust. And then if those collective things aren't the problem, then looking to, well, are they doing other things that are trying to ultimately, you know, shut me out in a way that's anti-competitive?
Could you describe some of the actions that your office has taken related to antitrust? And some of this has been in the news, and people may have got a glance at it, but maybe didn't pay super close attention. But these are, you know, pretty significant, I think, some of the steps you folks have been taking.
Yes, yeah, so you mentioned pesticides. Yeah. We have the Minnesota Attorney General's office with the Federal Trade Commission and certain other states sued Syngenta and Corteva with the Federal Trade Commission for their use of loyalty programs. Oh. So they use loyalty programs with these very large distributors. There's only a handful of them. And by using these loyalty programs, they've made it difficult, if not impossible, for generic pesticide companies to compete. And so it's a way for Syngenta and Corteva, we allege, to maintain this brand, you know, advantage that they should have had expire, continue, because the generic competition just can't get a foothold because these loyalty programs make it almost impossible. And we filed that in 2022, and we're in discovery right now. So that's one example. Another is the Minnesota Attorney General's office with the Department of Justice and certain other states filed a lawsuit here in the District of Minnesota in federal court against a company called AgriStats. And that's a data broker and consulting company. And we allege that AgriStats collected and organized massive amounts of data and information of certain dominant meat processors who are competitors. So think like Tyson or JBS. Mm-hmm. And they exchanged exclusively amongst those companies and for those competitors certain reports, and then offered consulting as well. And while the information they say was aggregated, so it wasn't specific to any company, because there's such a small number of companies in these markets, it's not hard to figure out. And the data is so detailed and granular that we allege it made so that the companies could raise prices on certain goods without really worrying that they were going to lose market share. So that is ongoing and in the District of Minnesota as well. Then we have a lawsuit against John Deere that was filed this year. And that's with the Federal Trade Commission and four other states. And we allege that John Deere is placing anti-competitive restrictions on the tractors that they manufactured so that owners are unable to get the repairs done by anyone but those authorized by John Deere. And that not only harms the people who own John Deere, but also the independent repair professionals who would otherwise be able to repair those and run a business, being able to use their skills to fix the tractors. And so that case is in the Northern District of Illinois, and we're currently in the discovery phase. But we did survive a motion to dismiss our complaint, so we're moving forward.
That right to repair issue is such a, to me, a really clear example of, as folks say, I bought the equipment, I should have the right to fix it. And that's so part of agriculture, too, is fixing your own equipment or getting the local repair shop to fix it. It's just, yeah, it really is. On the face of it, people might think, well, that seems fine. You're getting this, that's the price you pay for having computerized systems and all that on your tractors. But this really comes down to, this is something you own. You should be able to, you have a right to take it wherever you want and get it fixed, that kind of thing.
And they're constantly, I mean, as you say, this one is a very good example of the tech being in the case, because this, in my mind, is a tech case. The way that they deal with the entire tractor now is in a diagnostic system in the engine. And in order to even diagnose what's wrong with your tractor, even if it's something minuscule, is you need to have the diagnostic tools to go in and figure that out. And that's one of the things that they're going to constantly be updating and changing. And so the argument that there was a memorandum of understanding out there that might be addressing some of these things, we're alleging, as the technology continues to change, regardless of what the technology is in there, we want farmers and independent repair professionals to have the tools to be able to go in and assess on their own.
So you alluded to this a little bit, because it sounds like on this case you're working with other states and you've worked with the Department of Justice. But I was wondering, so many of these companies are across state lines or even multinational companies. Does that limit your ability to enforce some of these antitrust laws?
Our biggest limitation is our resources. And so going up against big national companies, we have the ability to sue under state and federal law for Minnesota citizens. So even if the actions are also occurring outside of the state, really our jurisdiction is fine as long as Minnesota citizens and Minnesota is being harmed. But as I mentioned, the restriction we have is our resources. And so antitrust cases are long and expensive. Often we have experts that need to assess the injury and determine that there was an antitrust injury and then how much. That's why we work together with the federal government and with other states. It's also the fact that I think when national companies are looking at their risk, their risk is higher when there's a multitude of government entities going after them.
Well, thanks for all that background. So I guess get to the nuts and bolts. If you're a farmer or somebody who feels like you're experiencing some issues that should be illegal or you think are illegal or you wonder if they're illegal, what are some of the steps that they needed? You mentioned documentation. Talk a little bit maybe about that and more about that and what other steps should people be taking?
So we do have an antitrust report form on our website, and people can call in too if they don't want to fill out the form. But I will say it's called a report form and not a complaint form for a reason, because you know there may be a complaint in there somewhere, and that's fine. But we also want people just reporting to us on what they are seeing and hearing and thinking that it may be something that's anti-competitive. Our cases always start off with investigations. And with an investigation, we need a reasonable basis to support serving a target with a demand for more information. And so then from that investigation, we can, you know, gather evidence. Usually one report with a little bit of information is helpful, but maybe not enough to get us to that reasonable basis standard. And so having individuals collect information. Documentation is helpful because usually if we are looking at anti-competitive behavior, it often is in communications, it's in agreements, it's in, sometimes, like I mentioned, in letter that's being sent about the price or terms being changed. So having us being able to look at a timeline and looking at documentation is really helpful. But also having more than one person reporting to us about something. And so talking with others who may also be experiencing the same or similar behaviors and submitting it to us, not necessarily all in one package, but over a period of time collectively is helpful. Because I think sometimes it's easier for us to find a story if we can piece together a larger group of people's stories, how this company may be treating multitudes rather than one individual person.
So everybody knows everybody in these small towns, of course, and everybody more increasingly, there's only one business supplying this certain product or whatever, so you're a little bit maybe hesitant to upset the apple cart there a little bit. But what if someone is afraid of retribution? Is there still a way they can share their story? And I know that eventually you're probably going to want people to testify and put their name to a charge, but is there any way to kind of provide information without that initial retribution that they might be concerned about?
Yes. So there's a lot of steps between contacting our office and getting to a point where that information information would become public. Information shared with our office is confidential, and we won't share that information. The ability for us to do something with that information, though, can be tricky if it's so specific to one individual person. And so that's why I mentioned, you know, having multiple people give us information helps us then when we get to a stage where we want to launch an investigation, we can be more broad in the request we ask for that doesn't have a target look at it and go, well, I know who gave me that information. We do think about that before we launch an investigation because we don't want individuals to be outed because they do have legitimate concerns about that. But sharing information with our office, you know, is confidential. We are careful as to the person reporting and whether or not they want it to be more broad. I'll give an example of, like, with the John Deere case, we're currently would be very interested in talking with people about it, and people can talk to our office, and we don't share that information with any of our counterparts that we're working on the case with unless and until they're comfortable with us sharing it. And then each stage, they can make a decision. You know, do they want to share the information with the federal enforcer to help strengthen our case? If yes, great. If they don't, that's fine. And then another stage is if you are comfortable, your story is a particularly good story for us to be able to demonstrate to a court that this is important. And we know that people in the thick of it, it's really tough. Sometimes we find the people who have recently retired or recently exited farming or a given market might be able to tell their story more freely. So if you know people in your community that are in those circumstances where they have had experience and don't necessarily have themselves in a position where they're directly dealing with that company anymore, those are people who maybe more easily be able to share their story.
Have you been hearing from folks, I guess, in concerned about antitrust? I know you've been hearing from folks at some of our meetings, and you've had some other meetings in rural communities, I guess, both through those, but also have people been contacting the office and filling out the form about related to issues related to agriculture and some of this unfair market control and antitrust issues?
So I think we've had our antitrust report form in place for a couple years now, and we get a measurable number of reports every month, and we take turns looking through them and responding to them. And so we do get individuals contacting our office about not just agriculture, but other issues as well. You know, in rural communities, healthcare is another big issue. And so anyone who contacts our office can expect to hear back from us, so it doesn't just go into the ether, especially with the antitrust report form. And so, yes, I think we have been hearing from individuals. We could hear from more because
that's why we're doing this podcast.
Yes, we're definitely interested in, we have the capacity to hear from more people through our antitrust report form.
Well, I think part of it is just getting the word out, because state attorneys general don't always look at agriculture or have a division, because I think this is pretty special that you folks have a division, antitrust division, and somebody with your expertise running that, and so it shows a real commitment to that. Folks just may not be used to, when they think the first thing that pops in their head may not be, oh, I'm going to call the attorney general on that. I don't know who they would call normally, you know, but they may not think of that.
It's true. It could be the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. It could be a bunch of different places, because farmers are also very regulated, right? So yeah. Usually it's the regulatory agencies that you're most in touch with, but the attorney general's office in Minnesota is the primary enforcer of the antitrust laws, and we do have a priority of agriculture, and we are lucky enough to have our own division. We do work with other states, and we try to support other states because we know that this activity is happening across state boundaries, and we find that there's interest in other states. But as you say, some of those states don't have as many people doing antitrust, but we do have strong partnerships with a lot of the Midwest states who want to work on agriculture cases as well. And sometimes, if we hear about something through our antitrust report form, we can ask others generally without disclosing who or the specific activity, but we could say, hey, have you heard of this company, about them and what they might, you know, what have you heard about them? Have you been getting any complaints about this company? And then we can share with each other and see, because it may be that it is something that we can collectively work on together.
When we talk about antitrust, why should the average person, whether they're a farmer or living in the Twin Cities or living in the suburbs or wherever, why should they really care if some of these companies are violating antitrust laws and kind of really fuzzing that legal limit there?
Everyone as a consumer wants to be able to trust they're having fair markets in front of them, particularly when it comes to the things that impact their budget, housing, healthcare, and food. And if they're paying more for something because there's funny business going on behind the scenes, that impacts them directly. With the coverage of the big trials against the big tech companies, as you mentioned, there's just a broader discussion about how monopolization and consolidation are impacting people. And I think the average everyday person may not realize that when they go into a grocery store, there's maybe less choice than they see because the packages are set up in a way that there's four labels, but maybe three of the four labels are owned by the same company. For the individual, I think you want to be able to just trust that when you go and are out in the world as a consumer or as a business person, you want to have that be a fair interaction. And so for people who may not think that antitrust or fair markets impacts them, it does, unfortunately, probably more ways than you would like to know. But you only have to know enough to be kind of just more aware of what you're doing when you're a purchaser out in the market.
Yeah, I think about it, people hate it when they think the fix is in before they even walk into the room. That they hate it when they go to a local government board meeting or go to a sporting event. I think about that too. That's why people hate hearing about cheating in sports, is because they don't want to think that it's already a foregone conclusion what's going to happen before they even walk in and have a say in the whole situation.
Yeah, and I think for people who are in rural communities in particular, sometimes there are suggestions made that aren't realistic. Don't use Amazon. Don't go to the big box retailer. Well, that might mean that they have to drive an extra 15 miles. That may mean that they have to pay 50% more, and that's not realistic. And so for people who want to be able to support their small businesses and local businesses, this is a way to try to do that, is to be just more aware of the things that might be able to help those small businesses have fairer options. It's important for people to be aware. I think all of us as consumers want to feel like we are being treated fairly and that we are being given an adequate amount of options for what we want to buy. And so when that's not the case, and I think that's increasingly becoming not the case in rural communities, it's hard to figure out, well, how can I do anything about it? It may seem impossible, but there is a way to use your voice in contacting our office or talking with your neighbors, gathering information to be able to try to figure out if there is antitrust violations happening.
Do you believe you have evidence of unfair marketing practices you'd like to report to the Minnesota Attorney General? You can submit information via the internet to ag.state.mn.us/office/complaint.asp#antitrust. Or you can call 800-657-3787. That web link and phone number are available on the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 389 at landstewardshipproject.org. There, you'll also find a link to an interview I did with antitrust expert Austin Frerich. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.